morning, everyone. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Thursday, January 30th. Present at the table are Senator Fairclough, Senator Bishop, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Olson, Senator Meyer, myself, Senator Kelly. Senator Hoffman is he going to be joining us later, Tim, online or anything like that? He's flying today, so he wasn't able to make it. He's got other business elsewhere. Anyway, today we're going to have an overview by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. We do this once a year. Last year when we did this, Jeff's here. Last year when we did this, we got into a great conversation. It was one of the best I've ever enjoyed in the time that I've been in the legislature. And it was certainly evolved into something different than the normal overviews that we get, and I hope we can maybe get into that a little bit as well today. Anyway, so Jeff, if you'd come up or whoever's going to present, I know you've got your board with you today. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for the work you do, and thanks for coming down here. You're probably familiar to all of us, but if you state your name and your affiliations before you begin your testimony, I'd appreciate it. And go right ahead.
I'm Mike Martin, the chair of the Board of Trustees for the Mental Health Trust Authority, and we're certainly delighted to be here today. What the game plan is I'll go through a few slides with some of the basics, and then Jeff will go through some more detail and talk about how we've invested earlier and what the payoff has been, and then Russ will help with the dialogue, continue the dialogue that started last year that resulted in a new focus area for the trust on alcohol and substance abuse. So with that, if we have the first slide, here are your hardworking trustees, many of whom are here today: Lorraine Durr, Paula Easley, Mary Jane Michael, and Russ Webb. Dedicated and hardworking, and you couldn't ask for better. Who are the trust beneficiaries that we are serving? This slide lays out who they are. They're Alaskans with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism, and a substance abuse disorder, Alzheimer's and related dementia, and traumatic brain injury. And you can see in the right-hand column the number of Alaskans that are afflicted with these various disorders. The guiding principles used by the trust, basically we want to improve the lives of the beneficiaries through the items that are laid out here. Education of the public and policymakers, collaboration with advocates, maximizing beneficiary input into programs, and so on. You can read them faster than I can say them. So, we have advisors and partners. The enabling legislation set up 4 statutory advisors for the trust, and those are the first 4 on this list: the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, the Alaska Mental Health Board, the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education, and the Alaska Commission on Aging. And I'm not sure if any of the executive directors are here this morning or not. If they are, wait, please. There's Denise, I can
see. Hi, Denise.
Next, the trust has cash assets as well as non-cash assets. This shows what our asset distribution was in the end of fiscal 13. You can see the various components. Our non-cash assets are managed by the Trust Land Office, which is within the Department of Natural Resources. And I should have mentioned the cash assets are managed by the Permanent Fund for the most part. Department of Revenue manages a small portion of those. But these are the non-cash assets distribution, the land, land that the trust manages. And I'd like to emphasize one point on this slide, and that is on the right-hand pie chart, that you can see that the trust has full fee ownership on only slightly more than half of the lands that were part of the settlement. So that if the beneficiaries are to realize anything from the remaining lands, it's critical that those resources be developed. And I'm sure that as we go down the path of developing those resources, you're going to hear about it. Probably already have. The available income for fiscal 15 is laid out on this slide, the payout based on 4.25% of the net asset values, $19 million, and then we have money left from the lapse of prior year distributions, and we have money from the trust land office activities and a small amount of interest on the checking account, so that we expect a payout this year in the neighborhood of $26.5 million.
Is there a statutory formula on how much you pay out?
No. The trust long ago developed focus areas to organize its efforts. And this slide lays out what they are. Bring the kids home is an area that we're going to phase out because the prior efforts have been successful, and we've brought the kids home along with a lot of help from a lot of people. As a result of an evaluation of our activities in these focus areas, the board decided to continue our activities in disability justice, to increase or add a new emphasis area in the housing focus area that deals with long-term support and services. In the beneficiary projects focus area, we are adding a new emphasis on beneficiary employment. And then the workforce development focus area, we're going to continue our activities as we have to help develop the workforce necessary for treatment for our beneficiaries. And then, as a result of the dialogue last year, the trustees decided to add a new focus area in alcohol and substance abuse, and we'll get into that a little later in much more detail. But at this point, I'd ask Jeff to talk about our prior investments and what we've seen as a return on those investments.
For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. So how does it look when it works, when the trust is able to work with our partners and actually make significant change for the beneficiaries? You've heard about Bring the Kids Home for a number of years. This is a great example of how if you work together, if you use an evidence-based process that focuses on outcomes. When we started this project, the state had over 430 kids out of state in residential psychiatric treatment facilities at a cost of well over $40 million.
Hey, Jeff, as you go along, would you just keep in mind to keep us all kind of tethered to whatever the acronyms are in here, because some of these don't look familiar.
Yes. So those residential psychiatric treatment facilities outside are basically institutions for kids with severe mental illness and other related issues. Not only were you spending $40 million on these 430-some kids, it was going up. And there were no signs that there was any slowdown in the increasing numbers of kids that were being sent outside. So when the Murkowski administration and Senator Commissioner Gilbertson at the time approached the trust about working with the state on this, we began to pull our partners together and start saying, okay, what do we need to do in state to reinvest those dollars that you're sending out of state to better serve these kids and their families in state, and of course also create the jobs and economy that go along with investing money in the state of Alaska as opposed to sending it out to Utah, Texas, and all the other programs that we were funding outside. So we gradually started to make progress as we increased support services to families and communities, increase the technological ability to use evidence-based practices to prevent those kids from needing to go outside. You'll see that the trust was sort of the glue and the venture capital that helped pull this initiative together and keep it going even across administrations. As you all know, when governors change, priorities change, and often initiatives that might have started under one governor can lose some emphasis and lose some steam and maybe not get followed through on when another administration comes in with, understandably, their own priorities. One of the advantages of having the trust take on one of these issues is that we span those changes, not only of administration, but even legislative leadership as well. So the trustees spent $16 million over this period of time helping to keep this initiative together and keep it going. And for example, the kinds of things we did is when we had a group of beneficiaries that were had autism spectrum disorder, had a lot of behavior problems, very low communication skills, they were spending over 400 days on average out of state because we didn't know how to deal with that population. The trust was able to take people from the Division of Juvenile Justice, the Division of Behavioral Health, private entities like North Star, community providers like Anchorage Community Mental Health, and take them all to Maine, where there was a model program that had reduced the inpatient stays for this population from our over 400 days to less than 60 days by working very closely with families and community providers on communication and behavior. Because if these kids could communicate effectively and their behavior could be managed, then they could stay with their families or stay in much lower level programs. As you can imagine, it's pretty darn hard for normal state agencies to get a bunch of out-of-state travel money put together in order to go actually see one of these programs on the ground. We are at the point now where we are under 100. I think a couple of days ago we were at 94. There are a couple of programs like the one I just described that are still in the process of being implemented. That should bring that number down a little bit more. But FY15 is slated to be the last year that the trust will be focused on this initiative, with one significant caveat. We solved this problem once before. Some of you may remember the Alaska Youth Initiative. And we, before the trust was in existence, you invested in many of these same types of services. But we all just went right on to the next project, and no one was left watching how it evolved over time. And how it evolved over time is it got bureaucratic, costs increased, to the point where the legislature could no longer sustain the services that were being funded under that program, and basically it went away. And that was the beginning of this return to sending kids out of state. So this time we're not going to make that mistake. This time we are data driven in all of our work, and this time we are leaving data framework in place that we can continue to monitor. And if we see either the costs start to go back up or more kids get sent out of state, then we'll have what I call those data tripwires, that will give us early warning that something isn't the way we thought we left it, and we'll go back in and have an opportunity to look at it before we end up with another Bring the Kids Home initiative in 10 years. Another area that we've worked in is the Complex Behavior Collaborative. This is one that I know we've talked to you about before. Here's what we're doing. In a sense, this is a precursor to heading off what could be another Bring the Kids Home situation. What we have is a number of beneficiaries who are in either their home, the Pioneer Home, assisted living, and they develop difficult-to-manage behaviors that end up getting them kicked out. And when they get kicked out, they never go to a less expensive service. They always go up to a more expensive level of care. And so now we've started to see the numbers of people being sent outside again to ICFMRs, which are intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded, something that we don't use in Alaska, go up to the point where now we're looking at having around 20 people that we're paying for to live in these facilities outside, away from their communities and families. So the thought was, well, what can we do to stem that tide and that growing financial obligation? Well, what we needed to do was to try to preserve their current placements by assisting, whether it's their family, the assisted living home, or the Pioneer Home, assist them in learning how to manage these behaviors. A good example from, 15 years ago was a gentleman, a pioneer, Alaskan pioneer, who was in the Palmer Pioneer Home. And he had pretty significant dementia. It was pretty rapid onset. But physically, he was still pretty robust. And a very small Filipino aide came up behind him and tried to take his sweater off over his head without knowing how to approach him. Well, he turned around and decked her. Well, the Pioneer Home called the police. The police came out and looked and said, well, what are we supposed to do with this? This isn't a criminal thing. And boy, they tried to send him to Harborview. They tried to send him to API. And what we did back in the day is we started to help the Pioneer Homes be trained in how to deal with dementia. You know, how do you approach an individual like that in a way that they're cooperative and things work the way they should? So that's the fundamental principle behind the Complex Behavior Collaborative. What the Division of Behavioral Health has done, and I have to say, Rita Sullivan, the person who's working on this, has just done a great job. What we've done is collect a stable of expert consultants in various areas of disability and behavior programming. Experts in dementia, experts in autism, experts in other behavioral issues. And we match them up, sort of like the old Mission Impossible, where you go through the photos and say, which are the right people to work with this family and this individual? And we link them up with that placement, and they train folks on how to deal with this person in their current environment. Now, it has two benefits. One, of course, is it keeps those folks where they are and keeps them from moving up the intensity of service scale. The other thing it does is it improves the ability of those settings to keep other people there, because now their basic skill level has increased as they've found success with a particular population. Now, as you can see from the funding scenario here, the trust was partnering with you at the beginning in FY12. Through negotiation, we even increased our contribution in FY13. For FY14, the program is currently fully funded with GFMH, and all of the GFMH increments to date have been OTIs, one-time increments. Now, how do we know this works? Well, here's an example for FY13 for the 14 participants that have gone through the program, and we have data both for a period of time before they were in the Complex Behavior Collaborative and a period of time after they were in the Complex Behavior Collaborative. And you can see that we were spending $600,000 for those 14 individuals before they got into the CBC, only $400,000 afterwards, and the cost per participant was just over $12,000. Now, the reason I highlighted those two in yellow and in green is this is what happens when the CBC fails. It's not going to be successful with everyone. The one in yellow was a young man who ended up in one of these intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded outside. You're now paying $140,000 a year for that individual because we could not figure out how to keep them here in Alaska. The other individual in green was an adolescent that ended up in a residential psychiatric treatment facility, which is, again, those institutions for kids with severe emotional disturbances. That one's costing us $90,000 a year. So you can see the price of failure here is pretty significant. And by the way, the $200,000 savings that you see there is not just a one-time thing. As long as those folks can be maintained in these lower levels of care, that savings reoccurs every single year. So you'll see the same savings on these 14 people, cumulative, year after year. And of course, as the CBC works on the next 15 people and the next 15 people, we think that this is one of the types of investments that makes sense from a fiscal policy standpoint. Because as Representative Newman has said recently, we can't cut our way to a sustainable budget. Somehow we have to cut our front-end costs over the long term. And we think this is a very critical program to get that achieved. Now, what happens when it doesn't work? Well, I use this slide because in 2009, ICER presented this to the legislature. And the dotted line in blue was the projection of what would happen to the prison population and when you would have to build prisons if you basically kept doing what you'd always been doing. And then the red dotted line was a potential scenario if you did what Texas and Washington State and other states are doing now, which is investing in strategies that would specifically reduce recidivism. And the reason I use this slide is that 5 years later, I'm sorry to tell you that you are firmly on track to follow the blue line. And already, as you know, there are discussions about the need to build another prison in 2018. And so you're right on schedule to continue to move in this direction. Now, why is this such a big deal to the trust? Well, 42% of all inmates in the Department of Corrections are trust beneficiaries. 38% of all the inmates could qualify as trust beneficiaries solely because of their chronic alcohol use and abuse. 26% would qualify based upon their mental illness. Now, this is of all inmates in corrections. Now, as far as the alcohol involvement goes, if you look at individuals in corrections that may not rise to the level of being beneficiaries, but have had alcohol as a significant factor in their incarceration, those numbers are even higher. And that's why, based upon really the conversation that we started last year with this committee, the trustees have elected to take up the challenge that was issued by the chair and looked at a legacy for Alaska addressing the impacts of alcohol. Why are we interested in this legacy? You can see here the annual cost of alcohol in Alaska. The $670 million is lost productivity. Those are people that don't come to work because they're hungover, or they come to work hungover and don't perform well. That's a cost to all of the private sector industry that deals with the impacts of alcohol. The left-hand pieces of the pie are the ones that should be the most critical to this committee, because that's where you pay the bill. You pay over $200 million in criminal justice and protective services. You pay over $237 million for health care. And you can see the other numbers there as well. One more slide on impacts before I turn it over to Russ. Again, you can see these other impacts of alcohol and substance abuse. 18,000 arrests, 8,000 victims of alcohol and drug-associated crimes, 45,000 hospital days, over 2,000 nursing home and long-term care days, 27 per 10,000 live births, or 700 babies a year with FAS. 27% of all Alaskans have experienced at least one alcohol or drug-related sexual assault or rape, and 45% of all suicides were proven or suspected of having intoxication as part of what drove their behavior. And with that, I will turn it over to Russ.
Thank you, Jeff. For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Russ Webb. I'm a trustee of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. As Jeff noted, we had an excellent discussion in this committee last year. It was heartening to us, and I believe heartening to you as well. And I think it prompted all of us to walk away with the idea that we potentially have a great partnership. There are other partners out there with whom we need to and are working, and that there's lots to be done. Key things for us in focusing on the impacts of alcohol and substance abuse is interventions that are comprehensive, outcome focused, and will emphasize early prevention and early intervention, decrease all the negative impacts that Jeff described, along with some others that we haven't described but with which all of us are aware, and reduce the long-term financial burden on the state and local budgets. And Jeff alluded to that earlier. There are many ways beyond those that we've listed where alcohol impacts our expenditures. From the trustees spent a good bit of time talking about this issue, and we've talked about it with other partners as well, and we've all concluded that to be effective in achieving the types of change we want, the solutions have to be comprehensive. They have to include multiple components and multiple strategies, ranging from prevention and early intervention with children and families, education, early childhood mental health, primary care, all the way to harm reduction. For sadly, there are Alaskans today for whom prevention and, honestly, even treatment is too late. For those people who are severely impacted, most generally with complicating health problems, developmental disabilities, mental illness, to the best we can do for them and for ourselves is to reduce the harm that they do to themselves and their cost to society. And doing that through programs such as Carlick Manor in Anchorage, where folks get a home, structure, and the result being that they harm themselves less, and they present fewer problems to society and fewer costs, honestly. In an effort to do this, in addition to being comprehensive, we have to look across systems and collaborate across systems. We can't just look at health and social services and alcohol treatment here and corrections over here and health care over here. The truth is, we're all human beings and we access all of these systems. Folks with alcohol problems access and affect these systems disproportionately to the rest of us. So we have to look at holistic approaches that really address the problem. A key issue is access to treatment. There are people today, my wife is a district court judge in Anchorage. I hear this every day about people who are coming through her court who she can order to treatment and does order to treatment, but who cannot get into treatment for sometimes 6 months. Well, in the meantime, they've racked up two or three more offenses, and we've ended up spending a lot more money. If we're going to have an impact on our criminal justice system, we have to address that issue. Same-day access and other efficiencies, the Commissioner of Health and Social Services and the Trust are working on patient-centered medical home, looking at ways that we can take a holistic approach to the medical system. We have to enhance tribal partnerships in the state. The tribal health system serves a large number of our citizens and does so well. Those folks are disproportionately affected by alcohol problems. They have a great interest in addressing this issue. We are working currently with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, South Central Foundation, and others to begin to develop the kinds of comprehensive approach that we need. We will have to work on environmental strategies, changing, as we did with tobacco, some of the ways that we as a society approach alcohol. Jeff has been working, along with others, on looking at changes to Title IV that would help us better serve both the alcohol industry and our society by making sure that we are doing what Title IV intended to do and in establishing the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, beginning to control some things around how we sell, dispense, and do other things with alcohol in the same way that we've done with cigarettes relating to kids. Kids have much less access to tobacco than they once did. We can do similar kinds of things with alcohol. And frankly, those have been strategies that have worked elsewhere. legacy investments, maximizing the impact. The trust, there are, as I said, many partners in this effort. The trust has, as you know, established a focus area on alcohol and substance abuse. Another initiative headed primarily by the Rasmussen Foundation, but with work from the Trust and many, many others, is a Recover Alaska. The Mat-Su Health Foundation has a tremendous emphasis on substance abuse and trauma. There's the Alaska Resiliency Partnership, and Senator Kelly has convened his own group to work on this issue. We are all partners in this effort. In terms of the trust focus on alcohol and substance abuse prevention and treatment, we walked away last year saying, we all agree, we need a legacy. We need to do something really important for this state, and there's nothing more important that we can do. We adopted this as a focus area. We committed $400,000 last year and $1 million this year. In my view, frankly, that's a ramp up. While we determine the best mix of strategies, the best mix of components, the timing of the strategies, and how we work best with our partners to coordinate the implementation of those things. We will be emphasizing addressing the whole continuum of care from prevention to recovery, because we know, and we know from evidence-based studies, that you have to do this to have the kind of impact that we all want to have. Talk a little bit about Recover Alaska. It's, as I said, joint leadership, Rasmussen Foundation, the Mat-Su Health Foundation, the Trust, the Department of Health and Social Services, with many, many others. It's a great partnership. with people from all over the state working very hard to develop strategies. Again, through that effort, we're looking at communications, informing people, getting information. The polling issue really is a survey. What do Alaskans know about the alcohol problem? What do they believe about alcohol? What are the myths and mythologies? And how do we begin to address those things so that people have good information? Another strategy is a one-stop shop. Let's help people get to treatment when they need it and want it. And also changing positive social norms, implementing positive social norms so that people know how to behave positively around alcohol, particularly children, as they grow. The Mat-Su Health Foundation, their substance abuse and trauma emphasis, in that effort, they've done a community health assessment, a household survey, a workplace survey, a local health policy assessment, and held 23 community meetings. The result was alcohol and substance abuse was identified as the top issue in Mat-Su. Two primary goals identified through their process was having a community where all children are safe and well cared for, and where people do not use drugs and are sober or drink responsibly, a society we'd all like to live in. You've probably all heard a little bit about something called adverse childhood experiences. It's one of the largest investigations. It was conducted by Kaiser Permanente and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention to assess the impact of child maltreatment in on later life, health and well-being. The childhood traumatic experiences utilized to determine an ACE or ACE score are child abuse and neglect, exposure to domestic violence, household member abusing alcohol or drugs, depressed, mentally ill, or suicidal family member, a family member incarcerated, or divorce and separation in the family. If you look at those, and I have in a number of different roles I've had in state government throughout the years as a probation officer, social worker doing child protection work, director of the Child Protection Agency and the Division of Juvenile Justice, planner working for the agency, Division of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse at that time, every one of these adverse childhood trauma events is contributed to, if not, alcohol is a primary contributor, if not a direct cause of all of these things. If we are going to begin to have a change for kids and reduce the trauma and the long-term health impacts, kids who experience these things, the higher your level of childhood, adverse childhood experiences go, the more likely you are to experience problems as an adult. Adult alcoholism and substance abuse increases exponentially with the increase in the number of adverse childhood experiences. Strangely, as does your likelihood of being an abusive parent, your likelihood even of having future health problems, heart disease. So that kind of thing is absolutely critical. We're all partners. Senator Kelly has taken the bit and the reins and moved forward with the Empowering Hope Group. And Senator, I won't try to speak for you. I'd like to let you talk about where you've gone with that.
I guess it goes back to last year when several references have been made to that meeting last year, and it was kind of an exceptional meeting, and I would hope today that we can kind of break down the levels of formality that sometimes plague committees and they don't actually communicate with each other, and I think that was one of the most, to me, that was the most glaring thing that happened in that meeting, is that I've sat, Jeff, you and I have spoke about this, that for years and years I've sat through mental health overviews, and that was what struck me was, you know, 18 years after my hearing my first one from you, that my response to it and somewhat what you were saying were the same things, and though you had done a lot of good work over the year and I really appreciate the Mental Health Trust Authority, it seems like our mental health issues continue to plague us. And for the members of the committee here, Senator Fairclough is very aware of the Empowering Hope Group because she's part of it. And it came out of that meeting. And I think at first our initial attack was to let's save Alaska from all these problems that plague us. And after we had met, we had assembled a group. And after we had met a little while, we kind of determined that probably if we had to eat an elephant, we were never going to get around to eating that elephant. We might talk about it, but we'd never do it. And so we reduced our focus for now, because we still want to save Alaska, we reduced our focus for now to fetal alcohol syndrome. And that is the primary, that is the focus of this group now. And I think the thing I like about this think tank that we've assembled and the conversations that have molded what we are and what we're going to be in the future is that we are not interested in managing the problem, and that was a focus of the discussion last year, is that the legislature has put the mental health community, I think, in the position of managing the problem too much and not giving them the resources they need or the leeway they need to actually eradicate some of these problems. And so what we decided is our focus was going to be to eradicate fetal alcohol syndrome. I always tell this story, and Senator Fairclough has heard it 100 times, but in this group, this think tank that we've assembled, there's a word that we use, or two words that we use, that kind of say it all, and the word is leg brace. Early on, what we decided was that you could look at Jonas Salk as he was peering into the microscope and expending his resources on a cure for polio. You could have criticized him that, well, all these people out here who need better leg braces. And his idea was to just get rid of the disease. And so as we have our discussions in this think tank and look for solutions, if someone begins to go off on the road to managing the problem or even helping the people that currently have it, it breaks our heart, but that's just not our thing. We want to make sure that the people who are dealing with fetal alcohol syndrome, the people that have it, the people that are causing it, that they get as much help as they need. In any way we can help, that's fine, but our focus is not on those people, it's on eradicating this. So we put together the group after Jeff showed up at my door after the conversation, and he says, this big thing you're talking about, what do you call it? And we didn't have a name, and so we said, call it Fred. So those of us who are in the group always call it Fred, but its official name is Empowering Hope, and that Fred had no acronym. It was just a name to call this thing. And so I called some friends and people that, well, some associates actually, people that have proven to be servants of the state, people with a great deal of creativity and experience in these kinds of issues and some in broader experiences, and ask them if they would like to be part of a group to keep in mind at this juncture the conversation was just about saving Alaska. And a lot of people were interested, but they said something that I thought was kind of interesting. And it also gives you an insight into this group that we have and why it's a little different maybe than things that we've done in the past. Each one of them said, you know, just really not interested in serving on some commission and, you know, working to study something. And that really informed how we were to proceed, because there was a couple of holdouts that we really wanted, one in particular who was a former judge. And we had to prove to her that this was a group that was going to get things done rather than just work to a report. So rather than have the Senate president appoint somebody and the House member appoint somebody, the Supreme Court's appoint someone and the governor like that, and then work to study this. We just threw together a think tank to work for solutions, and then Senator Fairclough and I can, with hope, get consensus from the body that some of these things that we're working on are good ideas, and maybe we can implement some of the things that are coming from the think tank. The members of the think tank are Jeff Jesse, of course, he's on it. You couldn't ask for a better experience quotient than he has. Val Davidson from the Western Region. Nisha Steinkirker was the former judge. She used to be presiding judge of the 4th Judicial District, which includes Bethel and much of Western Alaska and Fairbanks. Mark Hamilton, university president, and of course he has a long history in the military. Reggie Jewell, I think everybody is probably familiar with Reggie Jewell. And Norm Phillips, who was a former CEO of Doyon and has personal experience in his family with FAS. The group, again, as I said, we're working towards eradicating it, and because of our emphasis on getting rid of it, we've attracted some interesting eyes. You know, one of them is the University of San Diego. Is that
UCAL San Diego, or is that just the University of San Diego?
It's the University of San Diego, and I'm sure maybe there's a few other associations in there, but they want to study what we're doing. So they have kind of partnered with us in a very loose sense at this point. And we're going to work to get rid of this thing, and we realize that we can't do it from sitting here in this finance committee or from the governor's office or from your office, Jeff, or from any of the commissioner's office that may have to deal with alcoholism and fetal alcohol syndrome. It's going to be at the cellular level. Foundational to what we're trying to do is to identify what we call natural responders. And these natural responders are the people in the different communities that everybody knows that's your go-to person. That's the person that can get things done. That's the person that knows what's going on. Obviously, alcoholism and fetal alcohol syndrome are a statewide problem. The problem is particularly acute in rural Alaska, but rural Alaska presents some difficulties in addressing this problem because the communities are so far-flung, they're so small, and there's a lack of infrastructure in a lot of the communities to deal with this. But the people are there, and they're willing, and we need to find out who they are. And when some woman of childbearing age or a woman who is pregnant is continuing to drink, they're going to know about it. And we hope to find a way to get them to respond to them, to kind of take them under their wing in the community. And if need be, we're going to have to deal with some infrastructure. I've been told by the commissioner that we probably have the infrastructure to actually give people beds to where we can give them a higher level of care in the state as we begin this. So that's part of it, is the natural responders. And then we also realize that there is going to have to be a huge public relations campaign to get people to understand fetal alcohol syndrome, to get them to understand that that's just not something you do. You don't drink when you're pregnant, and most people don't. Most people, as soon as they find out they're pregnant, that's it, they stop. We want that to be the norm rather than the exception. I guess that's the norm. We just want to make the exception. We want to end that. So I guess the three things that we're working on right now are public relations campaign, identifying the natural responders, and identifying the infrastructure barriers that exist so that when we identify someone who is potentially going to produce a fetal alcohol syndrome baby, that we can get them the help they need. And if it requires bricks and mortar, then I guess that's what we're going to have to do. We have brought in, we're in the process of bringing in private enterprise in this, because this effort has to outlast our tenure in these chairs. It has to outlast this governor and the great staffers that are involved and the think tank itself. And so we're bringing in private industry, and what we're finding is people are very interested in helping this effort out. We are, we've approached, and we're within days, I think, of our having nonprofits that can accept money. We, the think tank, don't want to be a 501c3. There could really create some problems with the positions that Senator Fairclough and I are in, and it's complicated. We're going to latch on to the First Alaska's Institute, I think it's called, and help me out here. Oh, and the Alaska Wellness Coalition. I have a mental block on these people's names. I cannot remember these groups' names. And then, just as I was getting the other one that I couldn't remember, we switched from it to a whole new group. Anyway, that's it. So we want a public-private partnership. We want the communities involved, and we want the businesses of Alaska to step up to the plate and start to take this on and make it something that will outlive the conversation that we had last year and the people involved. So we are like uber excited about this. This is the thing that gets me up in the morning. And if that's the legacy that we could have, I think we could be very proud of that we at least started the effort. Because you know what? The day people say, remember when fetal alcohol syndrome was a problem? That's a long way away. That's changing the hearts and minds, getting this state set up, getting those natural responders. It's like years ago when people never used their seatbelts, and now people just use them. That took a long time, but you got to start somewhere. And so we started last year at this table. And as far as I know, we're pretty far ahead, just in our thinking and the fact that we're moving forward, far ahead of other states. So we can be a model for others. And thank you all for the work you're doing. Jeff, particularly, holy cow, you have really, really reached out and made whatever progress we've had has been so connected to your efforts in your office, and we appreciate it. So that's empowering hope. And when you hear us talk about Fred, that's also empowering hope. Senator Fairclough, did you want to say anything about that?
Mr. Chairman, I just ditto what you've already said, and just add that the words empowering hope are meant to light a fire, per se. It is those of us who've been working on this sincere belief that if any mother knew the damage that they were causing their child for the rest of their lives, that they wouldn't make that choice. So it is about empowering people to make a different decision and helping them to understand that one drink does matter. And so to that end, I would just throw out, as the trust board takes up the issue, one of the things that we've found is that even in our medical community, there is a different way that they direct women in regards to alcohol. There isn't a consistent message that alcohol is bad. There's one drink is okay, or a glass of red wine is okay, because there isn't a consistent delivery inside the medical community of what's all right. And I understand that someone may have already taken a glass of wine, and the doctor doesn't want them to be fearful for the rest of their pregnancy. But it would be helpful if we could get the medical community together to deliver a consistent message that please don't be afraid if you've taken one drink, because it really is what it is at that point. The drink is behind you. But if you choose to take the next drink, that there is a potential risk to your unborn child. And there are different sensitivity levels during the development of a fetus where alcohol affects their development. But, you know, 9 months without alcohol is not the end of the world to try to bring a new life into this world and provide them for the next 80 years the best possible future for them. Alcohol abuse is preventable, and so it's my belief, and I believe it's the committee's belief, that a mother would never do damage intentionally. Thank you.
It's so just disturbing too when you find out that the one of the greatest indicators for a woman having a fetal alcohol syndrome baby is if she's already had one. And as we're learning, people who have fetal alcohol syndrome are more likely to produce people that have fetal alcohol syndrome. This is a scary dynamic that's going on. And again, as you said, if they knew, they wouldn't do it. But the people that are so addicted to alcohol and their lives are so messed up, some of them just can't come to that realization. But over time, we can cause the people around them to come to a hyper-realization of what's going on, and they can, with any luck, gather around those folks and help them out. One other thing I wanted to mention. Oh, go ahead, Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I think it was within our group in conversation. Did we not hear the recollection of someone that asked a woman whose children had been previously taken away from her because they had fetal alcohol syndrome? Do you remember that? I'll let you share.
No, please do, because you're reminding me of something, but I haven't got a fully developed thought on it.
So we were hearing from different people who had faced fetal alcohol syndrome, and they asked one of the women involved why she kept having babies. And the response was, because the state keeps taking them away from me. And so, again, I would reach to the trust, as well as we'll reach the administration. If we're taking away children from people who have alcohol issues, they're really likely to produce another child with alcohol. And I don't know how prevalent that is. It's just one story. It's one point in time. So I wouldn't suggest that everyone who has delivered an alcohol fetal syndrome baby would knowingly do that again. But I'm just saying that there are reactions to almost everything we do. When government gets involved and tries to make things better, it is not always with consideration of the full picture of what's happening in someone's life, which is why we're looking, you know, at more holistic approaches to deliver mental health services as well as other services inside of that, under that health umbrella, to families versus just individuals.
And for your information, too, thank you, Senator Fairclough. For your information as well, we have three pieces of legislation, two of which will probably get going right away. They're resolutions. We talked to the commissioner. He said it would be important for the legislature to communicate to his office and maybe encourage them to create some guidelines. The commissioner, we've spoken with him. He loves this idea, and so we anticipate we'll have the support of the administration. So we're excited. We have declared war on fetal alcohol syndrome, and certainly the trust is going to be a big part of that strategy. So, any questions or comments from the committee? Jeff?
So, Senator, yeah, we're working on this FAS issue. In terms of the larger effort, do you see an opportunity to set some objective benchmarks? I mean, what was helpful in Bring the Kids Home is to say we have 437 kids out of state. We want to get that number under 100. Where are you feeling the most pinched budgetarily or whatever? For example, do you want to set a benchmark for reducing recidivism in the criminal justice system? You know, we've just found it very helpful if there's an identifiable, quantifiable target, you know, whether it's financial or people or something that we can focus our data around. I'm just curious, you know, all of you have different subcommittees. Is there a rallying point here somewhere?
That is a good question. I don't know that we've really strategized at that level. Senator Fairclough?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jeff, certainly I think that someone who's delivered, we have a point with knowing at least children in the system, identifying those parents and trying not to have another baby born with fetal alcohol syndrome. We can capture those numbers, or we should be able to, and to target those. We can look at teenage pregnancies and try to drive that number down. If it's there, that might be another health indicator that's there. We would look to the trust to help guide investment decisions, as well as I know that you're taking on transitional housing as an opportunity. So I think that that's valuable too.
Jeff, maybe I misunderstood your question. I thought you were talking in a more global sense, not just on fetal alcohol syndrome. Was that,
yes,
was that the question?
Okay. But this is helpful, too.
Sure.
I mean, you know, when we do this work, there are layers. You know, there's sort of the big goal. What's the big quantifiable goal? And then as we have individual strategies, like, say, the complex behavior collaborative, what are those targets under those specific strategies? So this is helpful to look at the FAS rate, the teen pregnancy rate. But again, I'm sort of fishing around for some of those larger indicators that we can rally the entire state around.
You know, when you're talking about alcoholism in general, it's so difficult as it relates to the state. It's amazing how little is known about how much we spend in the state government based on our response to alcoholism. We have a research paper that was just recently done, and it kind of just scratched the surface. And when we talked to the budget people, and we told them about this report, their response was, can we see the report? Because they kind of don't know that. And that's not a matter of incompetence. That's a matter of how prevalent and pervasive the alcohol problem is. And how and we've stacked, too. And I think you mentioned in your presentation that you have a program, you start it, it either has success or doesn't have success, but it doesn't end. And then you go on something on top of it, and all of a sudden things get pretty well mixed together. And I think that's the kind of the collage that we're looking at regarding how much we spend on alcohol, and we got to figure that one out. And Jeff, did we give you a copy of that research paper?
I don't think I've seen it yet.
I'll certainly give it to you. I'm sure it will be helpful. Senator Dunleavy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you referring to the this particular piece? It's done by Ledge Research, and just some numbers. So in 2003, state funding was $1,146,600. Federal funding was $2,605,846. Other $1,421,527 for a total of $5,173,937. That was 03. 2012, the funding was up to $41,980,483. Federal was $16,477. Other was $5,228,759. So total of $63,656,000 for 2012. So it was about a 12-fold increase in funding over that time.
And I think that's 12-fold funding increase on those things that are easily identifiable. Ledge Research has found that there's some strings that you pull on, and you find that there's a lot more money at the end of them. That's a lot of money, $63 million as it is.
So so total over that a 9-year period was $362,897,000.
Senator Doctor.
Yes, sir.
I love conversations about these issues when you're around, because as a doctor you can shed some extra light on them. Anything?
Well, I like your idea. My medical career has been dealing with, you know, putting out leg braces, and you long for, and I'm not a Joan of Salt type where you go and nip the virus in the bud. So, you know, I applaud your efforts and energies headed that direction, because it's something that very few people have the vision and have the calling to do. And so the more we can do that, the more successful we'll be. Because I look at it as a physician, you see results right away when you do put a leg brace on somebody. And so it's gratifying from that standpoint. It's the people that are out there in the trenches that are thinking and going to the labs in the middle of the night to go ahead and do petri dishes and do all this other stuff that happens, as you've pointed out, that are really the answer to what this monumental problem is. And it is a monumental problem, because we are living longer. We, as was pointed out by the number of people that are beneficiaries of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, those people are, you know, just as important as we are.
Right.
And so because of that, I applaud those people, and I wish I had a better handle on how I could be more effective in being that Jonah Salk or that Pete Kelly who is seeing what has to be done, because you have to have that vision. And if you don't have that vision, no matter how much passion you have, it's going to be like a firecracker. You're not, as opposed to a bullet that goes in direction, hits a target. It's a firecracker, just makes a loud noise, and you know that's what politicians are known for, but such is life.
We've got to be careful how we talk around Senator Olson, because he and his family were having a discussion one time, and they said, you know, we've got a lot of businesses, we need a lawyer. And so so his brother didn't want to do it, so off Donnie went to law school. And then later on, or maybe I have it reversed, yeah, there's a lot of people in this community that need a doctor. We need a doctor. And his brother didn't want to do it, so off Donnie went to medical school. So don't go off to scientist school just because we had this conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I concur with, I really think this is a tough subject for me. I'd like to go to page 17. I have a question. Jeff, Mr. Chairman, on your second bullet, I had a over a 20-minute conversation last night on this issue. Of the 7,996 victims of alcohol and drug-associated crimes, that's what is reported.
Right.
Have you taken a stab of the unreported numbers?
Well, Senator Bishop, through the chair, there's some information out there. For example, the university's done some research around unreported rates of domestic violence and sexual assault associated with the governor's Choose Respect campaign. I think you guys have seen some of that data. Huge numbers of unreported domestic violence and sexual assault numbers, a very large percentage of which are alcohol involved. So we know in some areas that there's a very large unreported rate, but not in all.
Thank you.
Senator Dunleavy?
I think it, through the chair, I think you alluded to this earlier, but I just mentioned the funding that's occurred over the last almost 10 years. Earlier in the presentation, you talked about a program that was in place, and it sounded like there was no research model or data gathering method to it, and it just kind of went on and then eventually either disappeared or something happened. My question is, when you do an inventory of all the programs and how long they've been in place, do they all have some type of research model attached to it, or at least a data gathering model mechanism attached to it, so that you can see if it's having an impact? What are the benchmarks over a certain time? And if not, is there a process to abandon such a program or approach? I mean, certainly with research over years, you know, there's new information coming in. How do you go about keeping programs that are implemented with fidelity, that have data collecting mechanisms with it that actually demonstrate changes in behavior, as opposed to what may have been a good idea at one time just continually gets funded? Because the nature of the beast is to it does a good job of adding things, but it does a poor job of selectively abandoning things that aren't working. How does that process work with what you've been doing?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, one of the things we're working on right now is a behavioral health systems assessment. Russ, do you want to talk briefly about that? Or?
Well, a couple of things. There, one of the things that drives the trust is getting hard information. As you all know, good decisions generally come best from hard information. There is a lack of good information about the capacity in our mental health system, what some of the gaps are, our ability to treat people. We, along with the commissioner, said we need to know what's the baseline here. What can we do? Do we have too much of one thing, too little of another? What's the difference between the need for different types of care and our capacity to provide that? So we're looking into that. It will be hard to get perfect information, and I'll give you an example in alcohol treatment. We, in I believe it was around 2004, reduced our alcohol grants by about 45%. And the goal was to refinance with Medicaid. We didn't quite achieve that goal. We lost about 15 treatment organizations at that time. We don't know what the capacity drop was, and we don't know now whether we have a gap, at least hard evidence of a gap. Anecdotally, I'll tell you that we know that we have a gap because I hear literally on a daily basis from my wife about folks that she has ordered to treatment who can't get there. So there certainly is a gap. We don't know the magnitude. We don't know how what it would take to fill that, and we don't know this, whether it's a specific type of treatment. For instance, people with co-occurring disorders, we do know that there's very little treatment available for people with a co-occurring alcohol and mental illness, or alcohol and developmental disabilities, or alcohol and mental illness and developmental disabilities, all of whom show up in our criminal justice system regularly. We're trying to collect the hard data as best we can, and when we have it, we want to share it with you, and we can all take a good hard look at what works, what doesn't work. We know what evidence-based practice is, and we know what works in a variety of different ways. That's not always what we have in our system, as you've said. We, and I believe the commissioner as well, are incredibly interested in moving towards an evidence-based system so that the practice reflects the science, that we do what we know works. So we're trying to get there.
You know, the Division of Behavioral Health has made some strides in getting outcome measures from the programs, but it's a tricky thing. For example, if your outcome measure for an alcohol treatment program is, well, did the people stop drinking? And if that's your measure, well, you have to be careful, because if I'm a provider and that's my measure, well, then I want to serve lawyers and airline pilots and doctors, because they stand a very good chance of getting into recovery. Don't expect me to deal with people with chronic alcohol problems, because I'm going to have a lower success rate with those folks. And if my funding is driven by my outcome, you see where you're building in an incentive that isn't exactly what we might want from a policy direction. So we've been working with the department on some sort of an acuity adjustment factor, so that when you look at an outcome, you can encourage the system to move towards the population that you're most trying to impact, rather than just having them start looking for a way to get their numbers up. So that's an example of why this is, can get pretty complex when you get down into it, which was part of the reason I was fishing for, you know, what do you want us to reduce? You know, if you say, for example, look, the recidivism rate is too high, you got to reduce the recidivism rate by 10%, and we're going to give you 5 years to do that. Well, that's something that we can work on. We can say, all right, who are the people that are recidivating? And what would it take to reduce that number, to control your prison population? And I will say that, you know, I sit at the Criminal Justice Working Group, which is made up primarily of public safety, Department of Law, the Chief Justice, the Attorney General, the public defender, and they sit around and talk about how are we going to reduce recidivism. And it's so frustrating because those are the guys that put people in. They aren't the ones that keep them out. If you want the group that's going to keep them out, you've got to have health and social services, labor, and AHFC, because people need housing, they need a job, and they need support for their ongoing sobriety. And it was very heartening to see Commissioner Bloomer from Labor personally sitting in on these meetings, because she's passionate about the role of the Department of Labor in affecting the recidivism rate. So you're right, we need to do a better job of holding programs accountable, but it's not quite as straightforward sometimes as it seems.
Let me just add Jeff's point about trying to set the right target is really important. It's important, and about the complication of measuring some types of results. And using the sobriety from alcohol treatment as an example, the programs don't necessarily have the capacity to track 1, 2, 3 years later their clients, because clients move. You don't control them, and your ability to contact them and find out what their status is quite limited. So the programs have difficulty that way. That's a real issue. The other one is we have, over the years, I've heard many people say treatment doesn't work. The expectation is it's like an on-off switch. You go to treatment, the switch goes off, you no longer have an alcohol problem. Well, any alcoholic will tell you that's absolutely not true. It's not an on-off switch. It's like my blood pressure. When I go to see my doctor, she doesn't ask me, well, have you had, 120 over 80 perfectly for the last year since I saw you last? What she wants to know is, what's the range you're in? It'll spike. I can assure you it spikes regularly. But I have to do my work of eating right, staying fit, getting exercise to keep it down. And a similar kind of thing, say, with diabetes. We don't expect that somebody who gets treated for diabetes achieves an on-off switch. The disease doesn't go away. When they get a pill for type 2 or an insulin shot, they still got it, and they have to manage it. And to a certain extent, we've set the target wrong. We should be setting the target to say, as Jeff said, we know that alcohol impacts crime. The 18,000 arrests that are mentioned here, frankly, are a vast understatement of the actual crime. Those arrests are from the uniform crime reports, and they are crimes for which misuse of alcohol is an element of the crime. Okay? DUI, minor consuming, those are the arrests we're talking about here. We're not talking about murders, rapes, robberies, burglaries that are committed under the influence. And we have judicial counsel studies from the 80s and early 90s that indicate that 78% of misdemeanants were under the influence of alcohol at the time they committed the crime that brought them into court. 90%, if I remember correctly, of serious felons, murder, rape, robbery, were under the influence at the time they committed their offense. Those aren't listed as alcohol-related offenses. So if we set the target at reducing recidivism among people who have, recidivism generally, but particularly among people who have alcohol problems, if we set a target of reducing the number of rapes, robberies, whatever that are, where someone was under the influence at the time, then we can work on that. And maybe it doesn't matter if I'm a person who has a previous offense and I go into treatment that I get the on-off switch. What matters is, do I recommit an offense, and on most days am I sober? Not do I ever relapse, because I'm going to relapse. We know that. Am I relapsing less frequently and committing fewer crimes and causing fewer problems for myself and society? And those are the kinds of targets that I think Jeff is trying to get to, that we can attack. And frankly, those are the kinds of targets that drive expenditures in the state budget.
And you have to be really careful about your targets. One of the discussions we've had with the governor's office around the domestic violence issues and the reported rate, if you said, okay, our measure is going to be the reported rate of domestic violence, most people would say, well, yeah, if that rate went down, that would be your goal. Well, that's totally inverse. What you want to do is increase the reported rate, because you can't intervene in those situations if people don't report. And so it's critical that you really think some of these things through, because if you set that as your goal, you might take a course of action, for example, an exclusive focus on very aggressive law enforcement, prosecution, and incarceration that might have the opposite effect of what you want. You might drive down the reported rate, all right, because more victims will be reluctant to report if they think something totally draconian is going to happen to their partner, for good or bad reasons. We can talk about that separately. And here you might be thinking, well, this is working. Well, not necessarily. What you want to do is come up with strategies that encourage those victims to report, because they think something positive is going to happen in their lives. And in the short run, you want to drive that reported rate up. So setting the goal is a crucial part of any initiative.
Let me just add to that. As Jeff said, in the short run, you want to drive the goal up, or the reported rate up. What you want to drive down is repeat domestic violence in the short run. And in the long term, then drive the total number down. And those are the kinds of, you know, it's sort of the, it's really taking a more scientific approach, and it's a smarter approach to both how we develop and implement programs and where we target, and honestly a smarter approach to justice and child protection and all kinds of other things. And we're trying our best to get there. We're trying to partner with you and folks in the House to get all of us there long term and get our state headed in the kind of direction that I think we all want to go.
Thanks, Rose. Senator Meyer, you had a question a while ago.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. And as many of you know, I've been involved with FAS for a long time. My focus has been on the helping those who, unfortunately, not their choice, they're living with a lifelong disability. And my wife and I actually are raising a child that suffers from FAS, our daughter. And so my focus has been on educational system. These kids obviously learn differently. And of course, as Terry and most of you know, a couple years ago, we had a very progressive bill working with the court system on having the courts take FAS into consideration before they do this sentencing. And I know other states have asked for that legislation, so appreciate all the help there. And now my partner over here has taken an interest in the prevention side. So I think this is great what we're doing for FAS and alcohol in general, and certainly tobacco. I think we've turned a corner on that. It's been a long, hard road. But some of the bills working with the businesses to, force their clerks to check ID, and keep it out of the kids' hands. And then we were lucky, I guess, that to have this steady amount of money through the tobacco cessation settlement to give us a steady media campaign out there. So I think, you know, tobacco, we've done pretty good. Alcohol, we still have a long ways to go, as we know. But I do appreciate this discussion because I've never been able to figure out why we're afraid to talk about mental illness. I mean, you were talking about your high blood pressure. I can talk about my asthma. Others can talk about the cancer that they have, or the diabetes that they have that they're living with. And we're all sympathetic, and we're all, oh, well, you know, I'm glad you went to the hospital. I'm glad you got some help. But if I was to tell you that, you know, I've got mood swings, I've got anxiety, I've got depression, people are going to look at you differently. And instead of saying, you know, go to Providence Hospital and get help, you know, you're reluctant to say, well, I need to go to a behavioral hospital for help, whether it be API or North Star or whatever. So we got to get past that and talk more openly about mental illness. You know, I don't know what the right budget number is for mental illness and behavioral, but the more we talk, I think the better we can get a handle on what that budget number should be. I guess what's troubling to me, though, now, you know, I think if we were to vote on legalizing tobacco, we probably wouldn't, knowing what we know about tobacco. So are we making a mistake by legalizing marijuana, and should we be more progressive on that and more intervention? And I'd like to hear what the trust thinks about that. Because I'm thinking if that gets on the ballot, gets legalized, our 30, 40, 50 years from now, we're going to say, man, wish we hadn't done that. So I'd like to hear your comments on that.
The trust has really not discussed that particular issue. That it was raised with us yesterday, and I can assure you that we will discuss the issue, but we have not yet to date, Senator.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. I just think, though, if you folks have a position on it, you should try to make it as public as possible before August. because I keep hearing, well, marijuana is okay because it's not as harmful as alcohol. And that may be true. I don't know. I just don't want to, I won't be here 50 years from now discussing the harmful effects of marijuana and why we legalize this. But I think it deserves some discussion anyway, so that we don't add a third thing on top of tobacco and alcohol.
Jeff, I just want to say, too, on your overarching alcohol programs, as I understand the conversation, you did want to work with us on some benchmarks. Mm-hmm. So let's do that. And I'd say that we could pull in the commissioner and the chairs of health and social services if they're interested, and have that discussion.
And if I can respond a little to Senator Meyer, I really appreciate that. You know, there's a lot of range of behaviors and even addictive behaviors that have a variety of consequences, from alcohol to gambling to food, and you as policymakers have to make judgments as to which of those activities you're going to find to be legal and which ones you're going to determine are illegal, and what the consequences are. And so I think it's easier for us to describe the impacts of the use of certain substances or behaviors than it is for us to make judgments about what you want to make legal and what you don't. You know, this is not a prohibitionist movement. I mean, we're not trying to have alcohol declared illegal and you know, that sort of thing. What we're trying to do is manage the negative consequences that come from overuse or inappropriate use. So I don't know if that's helpful. And as to your comment about talking about mental health issues, I really appreciate that. You know, 8 years ago when I perhaps ill-advisedly, only 4 months into my own recovery from alcoholism, decided to come out in front of the Public Health Association annual conference of 400 people. I hadn't made it from the Hilton to my office at the Atwood building before people in that audience of public health professionals were calling my trustees to alert them that they had an alcoholic working for the Mental Health Trust, and what were they going to do about it. And fortunately, you know, now with about 8 years of sobriety, you know, we're past that. But it's true. I mean, I think in some ways, because of how alcohol has evolved in our culture, my personal belief is the anonymous part of Alcoholics Anonymous has done more to hold us all back from dealing with these issues than just about anything. I mean, look at AIDS. That was a population that was pretty societally frowned upon, but they insisted on that disease being treated and made more progress in getting attention to that than we've been able to get around alcohol. You know, if we had at noon on a Friday, everyone in this country stood up and said, my name is Jeff and I'm an alcoholic, that was an alcoholic, people would be stunned as to how pervasive this problem is in our community. And 8 years ago when I gave that speech, I had commissioners and other influential people privately coming to me saying, yeah, me too, good for you. But I think you're right. Mental health and alcoholism, it has this moral dimension that we have not been able to shake, and that's really holding us back.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to add, just in response to Jeff's comments, that the trust believes in employment for our beneficiaries, and I think that's why we kept you on, Jeff.
Well, I certainly appreciated it.
Are there any other questions or comments from the committee? Gentlemen, I sure appreciate you coming here, and we appreciate the work that you do, and let's make sure we follow up on that overarching strategy for alcohol and what our part needs to be to provide vision and direction so that we don't just kind of take a powder on that and expect you to come back with all the answers later on. Okay. Questions? Comments? Any other business?
Thank you.
We're adjourned. Oh, we are meeting tomorrow, Chairman says.